Talk with George Norrie. Call the Wildcard line at area code 818-501-4109. The first-time caller line is area code 818-501-4721. To talk with George toll-free from east of the Rockies, call 1-800-825-5033. West of the Rockies, toll-free at 1-800-618-8255. International callers may reach George Norrie by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5. And dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From the City of Angels, this is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
And with our guest Daniel Derda right here on Coast to Coast, we'll open up the phone lines now, and perhaps you have a question or two for Daniel. And I'll be right back as we'll talk about what can we do if an asteroid is coming straight at us. Daniel, if an asteroid then was coming our way beyond a test, I mean, what do you think we can do? I mean, would you advocate blowing it up with a nuclear bomb?
Well, actually, I think we can do better than that. The problem with doing something like, you know, that sort of an impulsive deflection scenario, you either blow it to smithereens, which
you might create more little asteroids.
You've still got all this material coming at you.
Yeah,
right? Now
exactly.
You have a shotgun rather than one bullet. It's a very uncontrolled way. Remember, this very issue that we were just talking about, this keyhole issue, it doesn't do you very good to move an object that might be coming at you this year and move it in an uncontrolled fashion that lets it slip into one of these keyholes only to come back and get you again later on. We prefer, B612 Foundation prefers, methods that allow you to control the deflection. To do a slow, gentle, there are reasons for doing it slow and gentle, but the slow and gentle for one reason allows you to keep control over the object, to make sure you know where it's going during the deflection so that it won't cause your grandchildren a problem. Slow is also another good reason because many of these objects are fragile enough. We've seen evidence for this in the way objects have been ripped apart in the past. We haven't seen that ourselves in history, but we see the evidence of ripped apart asteroids in the fact that 1 in 5 near-Earth asteroids is actually a binary. They have moons. And the process that leads to that is having a weak asteroid torn asunder by the gravity of the Earth as it passes by during a very close pass. That tells us that at least some of them are relatively weak. If you try to go out and push aggressively or do something aggressive, if you will, to one of these weak objects,
it might make it worse.
It might make things worse. So you want to go out there and gently push.
This deep impact project where we're landing on a comet and we're going to blow part of it up in July, is that really a test to see what's this comet's makeup, or are we testing our ability to land again? I know it's been done, but to land again on an object and see what we can do with it.
Well, a little bit of both. The primary purpose of deep impact is to impact the comet. We're not going to land on it. The spacecraft actually consists of two different parts, if you will. One being a large, of order 800-pound copper projectile, which will basically separate from the main spacecraft and then just fly into the oncoming path of this comet. So we're letting the orbital speed of the comet around the sun, do most of the work for us. we just fly and maneuver the copper projectile into its path. It's going to strike the comet at about a little over 10 kilometers per second. That's very fast. And we're expecting this thing to make a crater on the asteroid of order the size of a football stadium. And that's the primary purpose, is to expose in that cratering process some of the materials on the interior of this comet and help us better understand the surface and internal structure of this, the composition and structure of this object. That secondarily actually serves the purpose of your second half of the question, which is teaching us a little bit more about this process of how one might go about moving or deflecting a threatening object. It's not its main purpose, but by you know, it's just it's going to be a natural byproduct of that process. We're going to learn more about what these objects are made out of and how one might go about pushing them in the future.
To the phones we go, Wildcard Line. Welcome to Coast. You're on the air with Dan Durda. Hi there.
Hi there. I'm John in Jackson, Tennessee. I'd like to ask John if what would the Earth be like if we were 50,000 or 100,000 miles further or nearer to the sun?
Interesting.
Hey, John. Very good question. That gets into this question of what is the sun's habitable zone? How close or how far can you be to have actually life? We used to think that the sun's habitable zone was relatively narrow, so that a small change. So if you live on Venus, for instance, it's too hot. Mars is too cold. Earth is right in the middle. A relatively small change that you're talking about, of order of 50 or 100,000 kilometers, that's already within the size scale of the orbital variations that the Earth naturally goes through over time due to the tugs and pulls of the other planets. Those variations do cause climatic variations. They're partially responsible for the cycle of ice ages, glaciations that we go through. We're living in an ice age right now, right? We're just between glaciations.
I think we are, too.
Well, I mean, ice ages last millions of years. The individual glaciations within those ice ages last of order 100,000 years. Right now, we're just between glaciations. The cycles, the timings of those advances and retreats are driven partially by these orbital variations that are on the scale of what John just pointed out.
Do you actually believe that we are going to get hit within the next 20 years? I know you don't have any data that would back that up, but isn't it just a matter of time, Dan?
Oh, it is just a matter of time, and it's just a matter of the size of the impact. Are we going to be hit by something in 20 years? Absolutely. But is it going to be big enough to have any consequence? And likely not. But I mean, we're, as I said, every month we're hit by objects the size of probably the room that you're sitting in, and those cause relatively, it'll cause something the equivalent of a decent sonic boom in the atmosphere that will rattle and possibly even break a window or two. In 20 years, will we be hit by something as, big enough to be a significant local or regional damage? The odds are not. I mean, things like, for instance, what I would consider a significant impact for me personally would be something of order like the Tunguska event, which, was 1,000 times more powerful than the bomb that wiped out Hiroshima. That occurred in 1908 over Siberia, flattened 1,600 square kilometers of forest. Those types of impacts happen on the Earth on timescales of millennia. So in the next 20 years only, it's not likely. Odds are, 20 out of 2,000, right?
Could be. West of the Rockies, your turn. You're on. Hi.
Hi. I have two brief questions, and then I'll hang up and listen to your response. Hey, how many years do you think we are away from mounting a camera or telescope of some sort on a comet? That'd be one nice ride.
Mm-hmm.
And the second question is, with the Vatican, I understand, just recently purchased this observatory, and the United States just recently launching this missile at this comet. I had this dream not too long ago about the Earth going through the tail of a wounded comet, and we just got pelted with great hail and ice stones that were in the tail of this thing.
Oh, very interesting stuff.
Yeah, let's take that one
those
first.
Are great questions. How many years till we have a telescope, an actual extraterrestrial telescope, if you will, not just necessarily floating in space like Hubble, but mounted on another object. In fact, we already had one in 1972. The very first telescope on the moon was an ultraviolet telescope placed there during the Apollo 16 mission. It actually photographed the Earth in the ultraviolet wave band because there's no atmosphere on the moon to filter out or block the ultraviolet light. So we used that opportunity to photograph the Earth from afar and look at the aurora and the outer atmosphere of the Earth in the ultraviolet. I have no doubt that as we continue to move back to the moon and beyond, that we're going to have other telescopes there. I think that'll be a natural byproduct of the new initiative to return us to the moon. I suspect, you know, a decent professional grade telescope on the moon probably in, you know, over 30 years or so, I would guess. I'm sure it'll be one of the very first things that we do as we expand science on the moon when we go back there. In terms of passing through the tail of a comet, boy, that was a big concern back in 1910. There were all kinds of crazy notions going on because astronomers had just recently, just before the 1910 apparition of Halley's Comet, astronomers had discovered the cyanogen gas in the tail of a comet. You detect these spectroscopically by looking at the wavelengths of sunlight absorbed by the gas in the tail of the comet. Or in some cases even emitted as the molecules fluoresce by the light from the sun, and astronomers had detected this, and people were going nuts because we knew that we were going to pass very close, if not through, the tail of Halley's Comet in 1910, and people were concerned we'd be poisoned. They didn't seem to be comforted by the fact that the tail was so incredibly diffuse, but. Debris in the tails of comets, though we do know that comets are the sources of meteor showers. They leave a trail of debris as the ices evaporate off the comet nucleus as they pass near the sun. Some of the rocky bits and dusty bits of debris are released in that same process and leaves a trail of debris behind the comet. If the Earth passes through that trail of debris, we see it raining through our atmosphere as meteors, but more importantly and more directly to your question, it can have some significant consequences for us, because if we were ever in modern times now to really pass directly through, close to the coma of a comet, and these things happen, and we had Comet Hale-Bopp and Comet Hyakutake in the last decade come relatively near us, close enough, and we could actually pass through that tail of debris. Not necessarily damaging to us here on the Earth, we're protected by our atmosphere, but boy, you know, our communication satellites, our GPS satellites are out there naked in space, and we could lose a significant fraction of our very important satellite constellations by passing very near or through the inner parts of the coma or inner tail of a comet. That would be bad. That'd be very bad.
Do you
devastating economically.
If an asteroid plunges into the oceans, a mile wide, what kind of tsunami would that create?
Oh, goodness. You answered the question by specifying the size for me. A mile wide, that's a significant impact that would probably cause a tsunami more devastating than what we just saw in Southeast Asia. We've talked about this for a number of years in the asteroid impact community, but I don't think people ever completely grasped the idea of what a tsunami can do. I think, unfortunately, nature has now demonstrated for us in a very graphic and vivid way and made it very much more tied to our experience what the devastation can be from one of these types of impacts.
Would it be instant, too? The minute it hits, how long would it take to hit coastal lines, let's say?
Well, these tsunamis can travel very fast. You've got maybe hours of warning time at best, if you're lucky, to maybe start to evacuate. I think if something that size were going to hit, we'd know it enough ahead of time to know where, and one could then be prepared to evacuate coastlines along the way. There's a trick, though, to asteroid impact tsunamis. The tsunami that caused the Southeast Asia tsunami was caused by tectonic activity of an earthquake. The wavelength of water waves that are generated during an earthquake are different. They're longer than the wavelengths made by the impact of an asteroid in the ocean. It's essentially a splash. It's like throwing a big cobble into a
And it depends
pond.
On the angle, too, right?
Partially the angle, although the cavity of water that expands doesn't know about the angle very much until it gets to be a very, very glancing blow. So it's more the fact that it's a concussive surface cavity carved out of the surface of the water, which then immediately collapses, fills back in, and then overshoots and drives these much higher frequency waves than are caused by earthquakes. The effect of that, though, is that impact tsunamis tend to break offshore much more easily than an earthquake tsunami does. And so that's the complicating bit here. It looks as though perhaps impact tsunamis are not as big a threat as we once thought, but if the impactor gets big enough, they can be.
Absolutely. Let's go east of the Rockies. You're on. Hi there.
Yeah, Scott from Ohio.
Hi, so, Scott.
Yeah, good show, Jordan. Dan. I got a question to go back to the intelligence on the different planets.
Sure.
If there's anything else out there. Start off with, I'll just go ahead and give this to you and then I'll get off. The Big Bang Theory. Possibly the planet maybe that was inhabited prior to us being sucked into the sun and exploding, causing the Big Bang Theory, and forcing us to go ahead and hop from planet to planet. You take, for example, the structures that are only seen from space or in the sky as possibly landing points or whatever, the pyramids and Stonehenge, some of the things that we can't really explain, were they kind of used for us to come from one planet to another? They're just so many different theories that we've heard or talked about. That's basically my theory of the Big Bang Theory, how the planets get sucked into the sun, and we've just basically hopped from planet to planet. I mean, Mars, they say, has water underneath there, frozen everything. What was Venus like, millions of years ago?
I've always had, Dan, and thanks for your call, Scott. I've always had a theory that it wasn't a little tiny pin dot that exploded and created the universe. It was a massive size object that exploded and created what's in the universe.
Yeah, the Big Bang is so hard for us to wrap our brain around because it's so outside of our normal, everyday experience, the size scales, the time scales involved, just the basic concepts. We tend to think of our world naturally as we do because we move around it in a very three-dimensional form, and so we tend to think of things happening in the context of, there's a room full of space within which things happen. And it's tempting to think of the Big Bang, which we have evidence for from, the expansion of space around us, galaxies all moving around away from each other, and the actual radio noise, the radio glow left over from the actual event itself, which we can detect. It's tempting to think of the Big Bang as somehow being an explosive something expanding into space, around it. But the Big Bang was the actual origin of space itself, and it's a little confusing, a little tempting to think of it in more conventional terms that obscure the real notion there. If you think of the conventional sort of analogs are to think of our we live in a three-dimensional universe which is curved and warped into a fourth, a fourth dimension, and is evolving in that way. We can think of it though by collapsing the analogy down to a two-dimensional universe expanding into a third dimension by thinking of the surface of a balloon that's expanding. The surface of that balloon, that two-dimensional surface of that balloon, you can think of as space and the universe, and it's expanding into a third dimension. And that, if you imagine running that expanding balloon back in time and letting the air out of it and collapsing down, you eventually hit a point where that two-dimensional surface of that little universe just disappears altogether down to this little thing. Well, imagine all of three-dimensional space running backwards and collapsing down into nothingness. That's the sort of event we're thinking of there. So it's pretty tricky to wrap our brains around.
Well, my, what a very fast show this has been, but we've still got a half hour to go with the rest of your phone calls and our guest Daniel Derda right here on Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Norrie.
This part of the show, listen online with Streamlink. Log on to coasttocoastam.com. Call the Wildcard line at area code 818-501-4109. The first-time caller line is area code 818-501-4721. To talk with George toll-free from east of the Rockies, call 1-800-825-5033. West of the Rockies, toll-free at 1-800-618-8255. International callers may reach George Norrie by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From the City of Angels, this is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
Well, on our next Coast to Coast program, we're going to talk about ghosts. You're going to love this program, especially those of you who get scared when you hear about ghosts. Paranormal investigator Brandi Stark will be our guest, and she'll discuss hauntings as well as weeping icons and other miraculous manifestations. But when we come back, it'll be the rest of your phone calls with our guest, Daniel Derda, on Coast to Coast AM. Dan, since the beginning of time, how many asteroids do you think hit the planet, us?
Oh, goodness. In the countless millions and millions.
That many?
Well, I mean, it depends on the size you're talking about, right? If you're talking about macroscopic, big, you know, telescopic asteroids, yeah, I mean, millions
good size
and millions.
Ones.
Now, if you're talking about meteorites and dust grain things, it's in the countless trillions. It's just a phenomenal number.
Okay, and now it's trickle. We're not getting a lot.
Yeah, we're in the tail-off process. In the early days, shortly after the planets formed, there was still a lot of the debris from which they formed, wandering around the inner solar system, and so the number of collisions were much higher in the past. Now we're living, you're exactly right, it's the trickle-off time, it's the tail end of the process, and it's much more rare.
So were these asteroids from planets that blew up, or asteroids from planets that never formed?
It seems to be planets that never formed. We see remnant disks of debris like this in the inner solar system between Mars and Jupiter, where we know that the gravitational influence of Jupiter keeps that region stirred up to the point that those objects could never completely accrete into its own planet. In the outer solar system, beyond Neptune, we see a similar remnant disk, this time of more ice-rich planetesimals. They're just little icy versions of asteroids, if you will. There's still some rocky material in there, too, but there's a lot more ice available out there. It's colder. And Pluto is just the largest member of this remnant disk out there.
So the asteroid belt is a belt of a planet that should have been.
It's the fossils of formation, yes.
To the phones we go again. Let's pick it up by going to our first-time caller line. Welcome to Coast on the Air with us. Hi there.
Hi, George. Hi, Dan. Todd out in Indianapolis.
Sure, Tim.
Listen, Dan, I got a couple of questions for you. What I wondered was, I've been kind of interested in the last few weeks, especially after watching the History Channel special about the Bible codes and listening to a fellow named Harold Gans, who was a chief cryptologist for the National Security Agency. He's also an Orthodox Jew. But this man set out to prove that they were wrong, the codes were wrong, and in the end he wound up convincing himself just emphatically that these codes were actually authentic. But in these codes, one of the things that they predict is that an asteroid is going to collide with the Earth in the year 2012. And I was wondering if they had gotten any of that information to you, as I know that they have sometimes relayed some information that would seem to predict dangerous futures events mm-hmm. to governments. And also, what impact is the failure of the Hubble telescope going to have on any of your research, if any?
Oh, interesting. Good. In terms of any specific predictions for 2012, I'm not aware of anybody in our community that's been presented with any information like that. I do know that none of the asteroids that we've found so far. I think we've discussed almost over the last hour the one particular case of 2004 MN4, and that's the only one that for the foreseeable next couple decades is causing us any concern. None of the other asteroids that we've found, I know, are on any list of potential impact, and most specifically not for 2012. Uh-huh. So I'm not aware of anything that's been coming our way in that regard. In terms of Hubble, it's the crippling of Hubble is an impact on the entire astronomical community, less so on the asteroid deflection or asteroid detection community. It turns out that Hubble is not very optimized for doing asteroid discovery work. It's a great object for actually studying asteroids that we do know about. In fact, I'm a co-investigator on a project to use Hubble to look not only to discover but to study moons of asteroids in the main asteroid belt out there. But in terms of searching for new asteroids, Hubble is not very well optimized because it's a very narrow field of view. For searching for asteroids, you like to look at over a big patch of the sky as you can to see as many objects as you can. But boy, it sure would be nice to keep Hubble working and doing all the great work it's been doing. We've learned a great deal from that great observatory.
Let's go to our wild card line. It's your turn on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hey, man. My name's Tim. I'm calling from Richmond, Virginia.
Hi, Tim.
Hey, I was calling in on something to do with, the chemtrails, the weather modification.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering, because here lately I've heard a lot about solar flares going on and danger maybe of radiation.
Right.
I was wondering if weather modification and making the skies more cloudy could have anything to do with trying to shield some of the radiation from coming down and affecting agriculture and all of us mammals and everything.
Well, most of the shielding effects that the atmosphere does for us in terms of radiation from not only from the sun, from solar flare events, but from galactic cosmic rays that are the bits of particles shot out at high speeds, the atomic particles shot out at high speeds from supernova explosions. The actual protective benefits of the atmosphere for that radiation occur even much higher up in the atmosphere than the lower troposphere where weather and clouds actually occur. So any attempt to do something in the lower atmosphere to help with that wouldn't really be effective. All that action's already happening up there much farther up.
All right.
In fact, that's, you know, the ozone layer is created by the dissociation, the breaking apart of normal oxygen molecules in the atmosphere up at high altitudes, like 60, 80 kilometers up, just from the ultraviolet light from the sun, breaking apart O2, two oxygen atoms stuck together to make an oxygen molecule. The ultraviolet light is so energetic it blasts the bonds apart that bond the oxygen molecules together, and those little free individual oxygen atoms sometimes then react with other oxygen molecules to make temporarily O3, which is the ozone layer that then itself is actually rather absorbing of UV and helps protect us. And that, again, that's way up in the upper atmosphere.
Hey, the Mars rovers are still plodding along.
Gosh, just absolutely fantastic missions, those. I was just at a meeting last week in Houston where Steve Squires, the mission principal investigator, started his talk with the very matter-of-fact statement that, well, we're now in day 420-something of our 90-day mission, and I just started clapping, everybody else started applauding, because it was just a wonderful statement of how successful those rovers have been. Spirit has actually been given a new lease on life. This is the one that has that landed near the these hills, which we have now climbed nearly to the top of. But Spirit has been, this is the one with the one bad front wheel. It's been limping along up the mountains with this bad leg, conserving, being very careful all the way to always keep its solar panels oriented toward the sun, because they were getting very dusty.
Well, not anymore.
Not anymore. They one day, just as we are almost in the same day that we started to detect dust devils in some of the pictures, these are common to people who live out west in the dry desert out west, see dust devils all the time. Back east, they're a little bit more rare.
Little windstorms, huh?
We see these little things out there on Mars that we took pictures of them, and then just the very day that we were getting pictures of these, all of a sudden, the power being generated by the solar panels on Spirit jumped by 50%. It blew the dust off, which has actually gave it a whole new lease on life, because we were getting very darn near the sort of death level where the spacecraft or the rover really wouldn't be able to continue doing much, and it brought it back to almost new again. So
that's incredible.
It's the Energizer Bunny.
I mean, and that may happen again and again and again.
We are now entering the dust devil, the dust devil and dust storm season on Mars. So you got storms that can deposit dust, but the good news is those very same winds can also help clear the dust off as well.
And they're well over a year old now, aren't
they?
Yeah,
it's just that we're into it's now something. It's getting close to 430 Mars days.
And they're still going strong.
And still going pretty well. They're starting to show their age a little bit.
Yeah.
And as I said, Spirit has got this little bit of arthritis in one wheel. Opportunity is going blind in one of its eyes because this is the thermal infrared instrument. It's getting cold, you know, and it's been through a number of cold cycles, and it's killing the instrument.
How far away are they from where they landed?
They have now driven about 3 and 4 miles.
That's so cool.
Yeah, it's just amazing. They were meant to go. The design mission was going to be considered absolute success if they lasted 90 days and drove a couple hundred meters from their landing site. They've now gone miles, and we're now into over a year of operation. It's just a phenomenal success, and my hat is off to everybody on that team who's done such a great job.
Okay, next up, let's go to our wildcard line. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Good morning, George. Good morning, Dan.
Hi. This
is Jose from West Covina.
Hi, Jose.
Good morning.
Good morning. My question is, Dan, can the planet Earth, with some type of phenomena, absorbed inward all the water mass that we have, all the lakes, all the oceans inside the planet?
Sure, to some extent that actually goes on continuously, not to necessarily absorb all the water and to make it disappear, but all of the water in the Earth's oceans is continually cycled through the crust of the Earth in the process of plate tectonics. These deep ocean smokers that you may have seen pictures of from the deep submarines that are photographing these little oases of life in the deep oceans, the discovery of those smokers solved a big mystery that had been plaguing oceanographers for a number of years, and that's to explain the saltiness of the Earth's oceans. The conventional explanations up until that time had been that it's just the runoff of material from the continents, you know, running into the oceans by rivers, bringing in these salts dissolved off the surface of the Earth. But that wasn't a very good explanation. Now, by studying the flow going through these smokers on the deep ocean vents and, you know, accounting for, you know, all of the crustal fractures along the deep ocean ridges, adding up the total volume of water being cycled through those vents, you know, going down a kilometer, you know, into the Earth's crust and then cycling back out as, you know, superheated water, dissolving some of the salts and minerals in the rock to therefore supply the salt in the ocean. It turns out that it looks like all of the volume of the Earth's water, Earth's oceans, are cycled through those vents every, you know, of order 10,000 years or so.
But could it be, okay, I'm trying to think of...
I don't think you could actually have it actually completely absorbed in so that the oceans went dry, however. I'm not sure it's that kind of a volume in one sort of event that would be possible to do that.
Because there was two issues. One is Sean David Morton's February newsletter that brought out about the tsunami in the Indian Ocean.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, yes.
And also earlier this evening, George brought out the aspect that there's no water in other planets that we, you know, our neighbors.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that it was, like you brought out, there was water in Mars at one time,
right.
Abundant. So my theory, my question for that is because when, Sean David Morton brings out that there's epic centers that basically there's aftershocks from like 5.2 to 6.2, approximately every 78 hours there's a gap. There's another earthquake that's happening. It's like it's straight lines going northward, and basically, Mr. Norton also brought up that it seems like someone is building a tunnel many miles below the Earth's surface. That was my question. I mean, it was weird and far out because basically, like George had John Lash a couple nights ago,
mm-hmm.
and he spoke of the pagans basically had the ability of remote viewing, psychic, and all this paranormal techniques that basically they brought out the aspect of the inorganic, as we call it, extraterrestrial aliens. If that is the source, my opinion is that basically all these other planets that are neighbors, you know, at one time had water,
mm-hmm.
and
there is some evidence. I mean, there's significant evidence that almost an entire ocean's worth of water was probably cycled through the atmosphere of Venus. In other words, Venus may well have been much more Earth-like in its past, almost to the point of having Earth-like oceans, which it then lost. Part of that explanation is almost certainly due to the fact that Venus is closer to the Sun. It has entered this sort of a runaway greenhouse effect where the atmosphere has been so heated by the contribution of carbon dioxide in its atmosphere that you just can't have water on the surface anymore. Any water in the atmosphere, any water on the surface would be driven into the atmosphere, of course, immediately by evaporation. And then once in the atmosphere, and this happens on the Earth too, the Earth does lose water over time just by just by the breakdown of the water molecules in the atmosphere, again, by the ultraviolet light from the sun. It splits the water into hydrogen and oxygen. The oxygen atoms are heavier, and they tend to stick around. The hydrogen atoms are so light that they tend to float off and disappear off the top of the atmosphere. And so that's a net loss mechanism for water, even on the Earth. On Venus, that process was driven to the extreme because of the runaway greenhouse effect.
What would water look like, Dan, in space? Does it stay together or would it fall apart?
A liquid drop of water out there in space would probably, if it was near, you know, like room temperature when you let it out there, it would, if you just dumped it out into space, you'd probably see it frizz and froth and evaporate away, almost like a like the liquid equivalent of watching a little piece of dry ice skittle across a tabletop or something
until it was
gone. Away.
What if you had an ocean out there in the universe? What would it look like?
Well, again, unprotected by a surface atmosphere, the motion of the water molecules themselves drives a pressure that causes it to rapidly evaporate. And so in a pure vacuum, just liquid water by itself would pretty violently boil and froth and evaporate away into just essentially a cloud of water vapor now, which then you wouldn't see. It'd just be water molecules floating in a little patch in space, which themselves would be invisible.
Did I see a picture somewhere that was taken in space, though, that showed, water in the universe? I mean,
water is, other than hydrogen molecules, two hydrogen atoms stuck together, the water molecule is the most common molecule out there in space. It can float around individually as individual water molecules floating around in interstellar, intergalactic space. More often than not, water molecules floating around out there will run into some little dust particle, say, which is often very cold because out in the depths between the stars, it's pretty bitter out there. As soon as you are an individual water molecule and you run into something very cold, you tend to stick onto its surface. It's cold. It's a cold trap. That water molecule just runs on and sticks. Other water molecules may encounter it later on and also stick. And so what you end up with is, other than water molecules floating free in space, you tend to have ice-coated dust grains floating around in interplanetary and interstellar space as well.
Hey, Dan, stay in touch, and let's hope that the next time you're on, you're not telling us live that there's an asteroid coming our way. Huh?
I hope not. That's not something I want to have happen.
But if it does happen, you will do that.
We will be the people you'll talk to.
Thanks, Dan.
Great to talk to you.
Dan Derda, planetary scientist, four-year anniversary with me being here on Coast to Coast, April of 2001. He was my very first guest. For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesour, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, I'll see you on our next edition. Until then, it'll be ghosts. Be safe, everyone.